Like to call to order the Senate Committee on Legislative Operations and Reform. Today, we are going to hold a public hearing on Senate Bill 50, SJR 1, and Senate Bill 456. It's an informational meeting, and we'll be hearing from a number of folks. We are preparing an omnibus bill, and it's not quite back from LC yet because we needed some little changes in it, but we will have it for introduction next Tuesday.
If all goes as planned.
So with that, I'd like to call up Doug McLean. Doug is legislative counsel. He's been working on this omnibus bill and is going to explain to us under what circumstances we need a public vote and under what circumstances we could avoid a public vote on this bill that's being prepared. Thank you. Welcome, Doug.
Hi, Mr. Chair, Member of the Committee, I'm Doug McKean. I'm a senior deputy legislative counsel. Marjorie asked me to come and talk to you about why we set up the bill the way it is and have the SJR1, which is the constitutional piece, and the referral to the voters of that part. When this idea came up for the public commission on the Oregon legislature, the advice that we gave to that body was that doing this by a bill by itself would probably have a separation of powers problem under Article 3, Section 1 of the Oregon Constitution. The legislative branch clearly has authority to enact laws. That's what it does. And it has enacted laws to establish salaries for folks in the executive branch, judges, and, of course, members of the legislature. In ORS 292.316, for example, even enacted a law that establishes salaries for the governor, the treasurer, the secretary of state, the AG, commissioner of labor, and the superintendent of public instruction. In the statutes that follow that, even enacted laws that set salaries for judges, Supreme Court judges, Court of Appeals judges, tax judge, the circuit court judges. In another statute, you've enacted the law that establishes a salary for members of the legislature. The legislature, of course, also can appropriately delegate its authority to an executive branch agency to do certain tasks, and it could delegate its authority to this compensation commission to establish salaries. The problem under the separation of powers article that we think exists is by giving that executive branch agency the authority to establish salaries for the legislative branch and the judicial branch. Certainly they could do it for the executive branch. So giving them the authority to establish salaries for judges and for members of the legislature is where we think there's the separation of powers problem. The state of Washington and, as I understand, other states who have done something similar to this and have faced that same issue have solved it by amending their constitution to create a constitutionally established commission that then has that authority to establish the salaries for all three branches. That's the way around that. The second question she asked me to talk about briefly is why we did a constitutional amendment as opposed to a revision. In this one, we were asked to do an amendment, and so it was drafted that way. We think there might be a question under the Armada decision, Armada versus Kitzhaber, that this constitutional amendment could affect other parts of the Constitution, could implicitly amend other parts of the Constitution, perhaps those parts that talk about the legislature's authority or their authority to appropriate monies. So we think there might be a problem there. We think it would survive an Armada challenge, but we don't know the answer to that until the Supreme Court would rule on such a question. The way around that, of course, would be to do a constitutional revision. The important difference there is that if you do a revision as opposed to an amendment, it requires a two-thirds vote by each house of the legislature before it gets referred to the voters. Mm-hmm. So there's that difference. So any questions?
Yeah. Mr. McKean, if we constituted this salary commission and then they came back with their recommendations for the judicial and the legislative branch as well as the executive branch elected officials, and we did not ask the voters for their opinion on this, the legislature could, in fact, enact by positive action their recommendations. Is that correct?
That is correct. In fact, that's the way the current law is. The current commission reviews the current salaries and then makes a recommendation to the legislature. I've been told that, as a matter of fact, they really haven't carried out that duty for some time. But that's the current way the statutes are set up. And then the legislature enacts the statutes or reset the salary levels in the statutes.
So in essence, if we went that direction, the legislature would in fact be voting on its own salaries.
That's correct.
And that's something we wanted to avoid. Okay. Questions for members? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the way that the resolution is written now, would the reverse be true? If the commission were to come up with a salary schedule and the legislature wanted to deviate from that, would they have the authority to amend or overturn the commission?
Yes.
And what would the process be?
Mr. Chair and Senator Bakken, if you look at, do you have a copy of the resolution? If you look on line 19, it talks about, first it says that the commission would establish the salaries, and then starting on line 16, it says unless by May 1st of the odd numbered year, the legislative assembly passes a bill rejecting or amending the salaries. So the legislature can come back and pass a bill. That bill would have to be enacted, meaning the governor would have to sign it. And if they do all of that and it becomes effective before July 1st, then the legislature can amend or reject those salaries that have been established by the commission.
Additional questions?
Similar petitions.
Additional questions? There's also a question about the timing of how soon we can get this whole process underway, if we have to have a public vote. If there is a statewide vote this coming May on other issues, which there may be, and we can get this through the process in time and get it on the ballot this May, would it be possible to have the commission constituted and reporting back prior to the end of 2007?
Mr. Chair, I think the answer to your question is yes. They wouldn't have to report back by 2007. They, according to the bill and the joint resolution, they make their report in the even numbered year. So they would report back in 2008, and then it would be the 2009 legislature that would have to decide whether to amend or reject those recommendations. And then
could we make an exception in the first case? And have them report in the first instance late in 2007, and then thereafter on even numbered years.
Mr. Chair, they could. The first opportunity for the Oregon legislature, however, to respond to a report by the commission in 2007 would be in the session of 2009.
There'll be a special session in February of 2008. We could respond in that session, and then the recommendations could take effect the 1st of July of 2008.
That is true, if you wanted to go that direction.
Okay. I'd like it drafted that way, at least initially, until we find out whether, in fact, there's going to be a statewide vote in May. If there's going to be a statewide vote on other issues, I'd like the committee at least have that as an option.
Okay. May I respond just briefly?
Sure.
That is the way the resolution, so it's the constitutional piece, is set up. It talks about the even-numbered review and establishing of salaries, and then the odd-year legislature amending or rejecting that. If we set up something that's going to be a one-time, perhaps, situation for 2007-2008, we'd almost have to build both of those systems into the constitutional provision as well. So we could set it up so that it would happen annually instead of biennially.
Yeah.
and then depending on when the legislature meets, I could...
But you couldn't... what I would like is I would like it set up so that in the event that we have the opportunity to go to the May ballot, that we can speed it up the first time only, and thereafter biennially is fine, right. On even-numbered years is fine, recommending to the regular odd-numbered year session is fine, but, you know, to speed this thing up, I mean, our judges' salaries are way behind. Some of the other changes that are tied to this that we'll be talking about today, in terms of reform of the use of campaign money and so on, tied to these changes, you know, the sooner we can get that on the books and underway, it seems to me better if it's a good idea, you know, to do it. If those are good changes, we can get them done a year earlier. That seems to make sense to me. Okay. If we have that option. So I'd like you to draft it to give us that option and then also have another version or amendments that reverse that and go back to the original intent in case there's no statewide vote in May. We don't want this to be the only statewide issue in May. That absolutely we don't want. But if there are other issues on tax matters or something else, I'd like this committee to have that option.
I understand.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you very much.
You.
Appreciate your input, and you can go back and go back to work. Okay. Gary Wilhelms and Laura Pryor. Welcome back. Thank you for coming. Who wants to go first?
I'll follow the lawnmower. I'll follow the combine.
I thought it was age before beauty or something.
That would be appropriate. Well, thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. It's good to be here one more time advocating for recommendations made by your public commission on the Oregon legislature. Frankly, I think it's a little awkward to be discussing how your compensation for serving in the legislature should be handled. But having said that, I am an advocate for legislator salary increases, for improving the compensation package, if you will, for our legislators and other public officials for that matter. And yes, I think you deserve a raise. Early in the Commission's deliberations, we looked into barriers to legislative service. We invited the recruiters from both the Democrat and Republican parties to come in and tell us some of the negative reactions they were getting from potential candidates for office. We received testimony from current and former legislators with regard to the compensation package and the fact that it was a disincentive to running for, at least for legislative office. It was clearly identified as one of the barriers to many good potential candidates. Not everyone, of course, but especially young professionals, career-minded individuals with families were put to the test when they weighed serving and their compensation package against their economic needs. And I know this is a little like preaching to the choir, but pardon me for going through some of the process that we went through in the public commission. So we're all aware of why we've lagged with our compensation package for legislators, I think, and other public officials. So we decided in the commission that we would try to be responsible, but to depoliticize this matter as much as we could. It's pretty hard to find another profession or occupation or avocation even where you decide your own compensation. But that's the situation we're in the state of Oregon right now. So the commission is the public commission on the legislature is recommending that we reconstitute the old Public Officials Compensation Commission and give them the authority to make the decisions in a politically neutral environment. Other states, the state immediately to the north is in a good example, successfully handle their public official salaries in this manner. The majority of public officials' compensation commission members being selected by lot from voter registration rolls initially sounded a little bit wacky to me, but other states are doing it successfully, like Washington. So after you study it a while and look at the results, well, it starts to make more sense. And frankly, I think it makes a lot of sense. It kind of does truly depoliticize this decision. We need, in the process of their review of salaries, we obviously need a review of the total compensation package, which would include salary, benefits, per diem, and the other expense treatment that public officials have and that legislators have. And you understand, I think, that our focus is primarily on legislators, the legislative branch of government. But obviously during the course of taking testimony and so on, it became apparent that the same concern existed for executive branch elected officials and judges. And so they've been included in the legislation. The Public Commission on the Legislature's recommendation was one of the recommendations that we made that was definitely tied to a second recommendation that we made. And this is where it gets a little sensitive for some of the legislators and candidates, because we're talking about reform in the use of campaign funds. We're all aware of the black eyes that have been taken in the press over some people, the exposure of some people's use of surplus campaign funds, and it was not illegal. These people did nothing wrong, but there were questions on ethics, and certainly the perception that went along with some of these activities was not good in the eyes of the public. So we are proposing legislative campaign finance reform, and it's in our final report, that would restrict the personal use of campaign funds, that is, for rent, car rentals, meals, etc. We are definitely proposing that there be no pass-throughs, not from PAC A to PAC B to PAC C. We're saying that should be prohibited. And the third prohibition would be over the payment of any civil or criminal penalties that might be imposed on the candidate or the legislature with campaign funds. Those are the three major recommendations that the commission made as far as campaign finance reform. But we're suggesting that if you're going to that the reason our legislative folks are using surplus campaign funds for personal use is because they have to, because they need to balance the books in some cases, not in all cases, but in some cases. And if we're going to restrict the use of those funds that way, then we should be looking at the whole compensation package for legislators, or vice versa. I don't know which is the chicken or the egg here, but they need to be worked together, I think, in order to solve the whole problem that we have. I'd just like to close by saying that in Laura and I traveled the state some checking with at least the newspaper, the print media around the state, while we were chairing the public commission, just to kind of let them know what we were doing and ask them for a little help occasionally if we could get it. And I have to say that my contacts with the press people that I visited around the west side of the state was neutral to positive regarding this issue. They get it. They understand that the compensation of public officials has fallen behind. So I think that we shouldn't be timid in moving forward with this, recognizing that it is a politically sensitive issue. I would encourage you to amend these bills as you see fit, but to ultimately send both Senate Bill 50 and SGR 1 to the floor with due pass recommendations. And one final thought, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I'd like to thank you again for the expeditious way that you are considering the Public Commission on the Oregon Legislature's recommendations, and I hope you will consider them all, including favorable consideration of the renovation of the Capitol wings. But I know that's a issue for another time. So thank you very much. I appreciate the time to be with you today.
Thank you. Thank you. Judge Pryor?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for hearing Gary and I again. When we were here before, one of the things that we pointed out was that the connection of the pieces of our report. And here you have two of them that are clearly connected. And they became even more connected in our minds as we heard testimony. Now, while we were going through this process, since I've been a county commissioner for a very long time, I began to talk to the county commissioners who had served in the legislature. after we finished our report, I've made it a point to call on people that I know had served in the legislature and talk to them about this issue. Because once you're out of the legislature, you're more apt to be forthcoming in the reasons why you would do something than otherwise when you were serving. And I need to tell you that this is a particularly critical issue for a lot of people that left the legislature of their own accord, were not voted out. This one issue had more bearing on their families and how they were able to just live and survive than any other single issue. Having been elected for a long time, I said to them, a lot of time, public opinion of the job of what you're doing or public perception of the job you're doing really grinds on your family and on yourself. And that's true. But if they had one issue that drove them out of this kind of work, it was the lack of compensation and their ability to survive with their families. That says a lot. And it says coming from people that had no axe to grind. They were already gone. They had served here and moved on. Many of them became county commissioners because that was a way they could continue to serve and they could be paid enough to have a family living wage. That's something that I hope all of you will think about. I know I'm preaching to the choir here, as Gary said, but I want to get this on the record. Because there may be some folks who want to look at this record and see what we had to say about supporting this issue. I think it's incredibly important to the future of the Oregon Legislature that you do this, that you give yourselves, but also those that follow you, the opportunity to serve, and that you are able to recruit to the best of the Oregonians, the young Oregonians, that may want to serve in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Wilhelms or Judge Pryor? Thank you very much.
Could I make one
Go ahead.
Final comment? It's about a matter that came up already in the discussion by the previous witness. In Section 5, Sub 4 of the bill, there is a, I don't want to say it's a disagreement, but there is a difference of opinion of what the public commission on the legislature's recommendation was. And it seems to me that in order to completely depoliticize this issue, or insofar as possible depoliticize it, that we ought to take out the language that allows the legislature to deal with either accepting or rejecting or amending the recommendation of the commission. There's no question that the legislature has to appropriate the money. That's the way it should be, and that's where the discipline ought to be. If they don't want to take the raise, they can just not appropriate the money. But I don't believe, as my memory recalls, that we recommended that the legislature should have another shot at the language from the Public Officials Compensation Commission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that language is currently in there. Yeah. My suggestion would be that you strike it and get it out of there.
Yeah, Bill, that would be an option, the way the bill is drafted.
I would personally anticipate that probably wouldn't happen. But
right. I'm listening to you. Senator Avakian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Was there any discussion about who and how the commission should be staffed?
I don't think we did.
I do not recall.
I don't recall that.
I see Mr. Barrow shaking his head wildly over there. I'm wondering if you wouldn't mind.
The answer, Mr. Chairman, Senator Bakken.
Oh, wait, Dave, we've got to get you on the record.
Yes.
Yeah. You can't talk from over there. Not allowed.
Way behind the curtain.
Yeah, okay.
Marjorie can speak to it.
Mr. Chair and Senator Avakian, I believe that we were looking at the former Public Officials Compensation Commission and how it was staffed by DAS. And I think that we are heading off in that same direction. Perhaps Mr. Barrows would agree.
Okay. Senator Morse.
I would point out that the compensation of the commission itself requires two members to have experience
yes.
in compensation.
Yes.
How did we read it here?
Background, line 11.
Background and compensation management.
Yeah.
So, and that was a discussion mm-hmm. that we had in the commission
yes.
to make sure that we had appropriate professional assistance that would know how to appropriately gather data, bring it together, and make informed choices.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, they'll have to have staff. I mean, you had you had Marjorie, and they'll have to have either Marjorie or somebody similar.
The final report, maybe it's not in the bill, but the final report, I believe, Mr. Chair, mentions that the staffer would come from DAS.
I don't know.
Right, the executive branch, anyway. I can't remember the exact language without going back, but I'll dig it out.
Certainly, it has to happen. Are there other questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks for coming. Okay, Chief Justice Paul Domenes, Your Honor, good to see you again.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Domenes, Chief Justice of the Oregon Supreme Court, and I understand the way in which you have organized this session this morning that I would be here to speak on Senate Bill 456.
Mm-hmm.
I was pleased to hand carry to each of you today a letter from Governor Chulongowski supporting the enactment and passage of Senate Bill 456. You also have in front of you an independent report by the Task Force on Judicial Excellence from the business sector, which is a very comprehensive report using cost of living figures, inflationary figures, and comparators to give you a full range of the problem in this crisis in state government. My remarks will be brief. I understand then later the panel of distinguished lawyers and judges who are here will have the opportunity also to address Senate Bill 456. So let me make some brief opening remarks. Today, judges in Oregon are quintessential problem solvers, community leaders that have initiated innovative problem-solving measures resulting in untold savings to the state budget, increased community safety, and strengthened the protection of children and families. However, the judicial branch cannot continue to fulfill this role with inadequate resources and inadequate compensation. Judicial compensation in Oregon today is not commensurate with the important problem-solving and leadership role that judges perform in our communities every day. Oregon judges at all three levels, Circuit, Court of Appeals, and Supreme Court, are faced with these facts. One, they have not received an increase in compensation since 2002, not even a cost of living adjustment. They rank at or near the bottom of judicial compensation nationally. By July 2007, if there is no increase in judicial compensation, Oregon judges will be the 51st worst paid, and that includes Puerto Rico. So we'll be 50th for sure and 51st for darn sure. They earn less than innumerable other state employees. They earn less than many of the public lawyers who litigate in our courts, and they earn less than many young associates in Portland firms. Judicial compensation is not a matter of judicial self-interest. Rather, adequate judicial compensation that is rational and market-based and that will permit the judicial branch to compete for some of the most highly skilled lawyers in private practice is at the heart of maintaining a competent, efficient, impartial judicial system required in our constitutional democracy. Just as lawmakers have an obligation to promote other essentials to economic growth, such as good schools, universities, health care, and public safety, so also do lawmakers have an obligation to fund the judicial branch at a level that permits it to meet the challenges of today and the challenges of the future. Adequate judicial compensation is not only a matter of fairness. It's a core component of the bedrock principle of treating the judiciary as a co-equal and independent branch of government. The future of the judicial branch as a strong, respected, and independent branch of government rests in large measure upon a fair system of compensation for those lawyers who leave private practice for judicial service. Failure to provide reasonable compensation for judges will threaten the competence, efficiency, and ultimately the public's confidence in the impartial enforcement of the rule of law. Thank you again for giving me the opportunity to make these brief opening remarks. And as I said, we have a number of distinguished lawyers and judges here to present this to you.
Thank you. Are there questions for the Chief Justice?
Yes, Senator Morse.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Do you see Senate Bill 456 as being complementary to SJR 1 or mutually exclusive?
Chairman Roe, Senator Morris, if in the Task Force on Judicial Excellence report that you have in front of you, that independent group has recommended, and I agree with this recommendation, that with regard to judicial compensation, there's a short-term solution and a long-term solution. The short-term solution is an immediate increase in judicial salaries. The long-term solution to this is, as we've heard from other witnesses this morning, is a neutral, independent salary commission. And so they're tied in that sense, but I'm here advocating that that we undertake both things, the short-term solution and the long-term solution.
Thank you.
Additional questions? Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you
very much. We appreciate your time. Okay, Wendy Johnson with the Oregon Law Commission. Good morning, Wendy.
Good morning, Chairman Monroe, members of the committee. Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director of the Oregon Law Commission. Senator Monroe invited my testimony this morning to talk about a very narrow issue that relates to some of the bills that you have before you today. And I just want to talk about the use of campaign contributions. The Oregon Law Commission worked on an interim project this session at the request of the governor and the Legislative Assembly to review ethics laws. So primarily our work is in the area of Chapter 244 for public official ethics laws and Chapter 171 lobbying laws. We did look at campaign finance to a small degree in Chapter 260 on the use of campaign contributions. And as Gary Wilhelms explained, there is an overlap on the use of campaign contributions with salaries to legislators and staff expenses. So I want to just kind of provide an overview of that issue for you, because I understand that you don't have exact language in the bills before you today, but you're considering that issue. If I can kind of back you up in history, prior to 1995, Oregon had very little restrictions on the use of campaign contributions. They were essentially the candidate's money, because there were no restrictions on the use of campaign contributions. And then in 1995, Measure 9 was an initiative that passed in Oregon, and it put numerous restrictions on the use of campaign contributions. The first was that it prohibited personal use. So that happened in 1995. In addition, it provided that campaign money could be used to defray expenses. Actually, the language was ordinary and necessary expenses incurred in office. That was a part of 1995, that Measure 9. Then in 1997, the Oregon Supreme Court, in the case of Vannetta v. Keesland, struck down much of Measure 9. But what was left was still a prohibition on personal use and a permission to use campaign contributions to defray expenses, ordinary necessary expenses incurred in office. Then in 1999, this assembly deleted the ordinary and necessary. And so you were left with that you can't use campaign contributions for personal use, but you can use them to defray expenses incurred in office. Nothing was really heard on the matter for a while. And then in 2003, the Oregonian began reporting on the use of campaign money for work expenses. And as Gary Wilhelms explained, that it was perfectly permissible. It was actually passed by the voters that would be allowed. As a practical matter, campaign expenses have never really been used by any other public official once they're in office, except for legislators. So, for example, the governor or a judge or a city council person would not take campaign money to pay for their paper clips or their office or whatever other expenses, but it has been an increasing practice of the assembly. As I explained, it's not prohibited by the campaign laws. In fact, it's permitted. It's not prohibited by ethics laws, and it's not prohibited by your House and Senate rules. So that's kind of the framework of the law there. In 2005, just this last session, there was a campaign finance bill in the wake of the Dan Doyle scandal, frankly, and there was a provision in that bill originally that would have prohibited the use of, or the double dipping, if you will, the using campaign monies when you also were receiving a per diem for the same types of expenses. But I must explain that per diem is not actually defined in statute, nor is it defined in the rules. And so, again, it's not prohibited. In fact, the language regarding per diem just provides what the amount is. It doesn't define what the per diem is for. And as I said, in the campaign finance provision, it allows campaign money to be used to pay for expenses incurred in office. So there never has been a conflict, but there's been a perception and a question of whether this type of use should continue. As I started at the beginning of my comments, the Oregon Law Commission focused on ethics this session, but there's an obvious overlap. There are two primary ways to influence any public official are lobbying and campaign contributions. And so if we're going to focus on the ethics laws this interim, which is what the Law Commission did, we couldn't ignore campaign finance contribution use in part. I'll give you an example. I couldn't give me as a citizen or as just an interested person, I couldn't give a computer to a legislator if I had a legislative or administrative interest, and it would be considered, you know, an expense that's beyond the ethics laws, which presently are at $100. But I could give money to the same senator or representative to go, and they could turn around and buy a computer with that money. And so we couldn't ignore that fact that if we don't close the campaign contribution laws to a degree, we're not really prohibiting the same type of influence. So the Law Commission's work group studied this issue for quite a long time and came up with a couple of principles that they wanted to try to codify. And those principles were that public officials should receive financial gain, or should not receive financial gain if it would not be otherwise available but for their public office. That's a principle in the ethics laws that we all sort of understand. Obviously, you can receive your salary, but you shouldn't be receiving other financial gain if it wouldn't otherwise be available. And second, the campaign contributions are in trust. They're not the candidate's contributions. They're in trust for the election of the candidate or the nomination of the candidate. But they're in trust by a committee that controls the expenditures and the receipts. They're essentially not the candidate's money. And it's in keeping in line with Measure 9 that campaign contributions are not to be used for personal use. The third principle that the work group really focused on in this area was that if you're doing the public work, you should be using the public money. You shouldn't be hindered because you're not a great campaign. you're not good at campaigning and lots of money to take care of you into session. If you're not good at fundraising, that shouldn't be the issue. You should be using public money to do public work. So those are the three guiding principles. The result then was a bill that focused on campaign finance this session, and that's House Bill 2597. That's sitting presently in the House Elections Ethics and Rules Committee. And the way we codified these three principles was pretty simple. We actually defined what campaign money can be used for, and that it is for the election or nomination of a person. Presently, it doesn't actually say what campaign money shall be used for. It has some what it can't be, but we actually said, okay, campaign money is, guess what, it's to be used for campaigning. So we defined that, and then we took out the Measure 9 permission of using campaign money to defray office expenses and put that in as a prohibition. The campaign money should not be used to defray office expenses. That campaign money is for campaigning. And third, we have a non-statutory recommendation that is coupled with these two statutory recommendations, and that is more akin to what you're talking about today, is that if you're going to cut down this area of campaign contribution use, that you also need to increase the salaries and the expense accounts, particularly of legislators. The commission and the work group were very clear that it was unanimous to come up with these principles, but recognize that practically that would create a burden to some legislators. And so as staff, we were asked to actually look at the problem to see how much campaign money was used in a given session. So I personally looked at 8 months' worth of camp C&Es and looked at whether this practically would be a hardship or what type of money we're talking about that the legislature would have to try to add to salary or of expense allowances. And I think Oregonians would be pleased to know, as again, in keeping in mind that it is perfectly legal, but many legislators spent zero from their campaign money during the session. I would say probably close to a quarter of senators and representatives spent zero from their campaign during session. There were a number that spent between $1,000 and $2,000 during the session, and frankly, that usually represented the purchase of a computer. And then there were a few that spent over $10,000 during the session. So the average, taking all that into account, is somewhere around $3,000 during session. Of what was spent. Now, there was no scientific analysis here, and we weren't able to double-check everything because legislators often are campaigning to some degree during session, and so some of those expenses that happened during last session may really have been campaign expenses. Obviously, that's a constitutional right to do campaigning, and it was hard to take into account, well, was this gas bill for a campaign expense, or was it to do legislative business? There's no box on the CNEs, and so if anything, the numbers are higher than what they actually are in reality of what were expenses incurred to defray office expenses as opposed to campaign expenses, which would obviously still come from your campaign monies. So in a nutshell, that's everything that I had to tell you about the background. Obviously, the bill, the Law Commission's bill, is in the House. I understand the Public Commission on the Legislature recommended the exact same language with respect to this campaign contribution piece, and so you'll be seeing the same sort of framework of deleting the defraying office expenses and codifying what campaign money shall be used for in a couple different forums, but that's the background. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Ms. Johnson? Thank you very much, Wendy. Okay, Janice Thompson and Chuck Bennett.
Well, Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I'll go first because I think I'll be briefest on this. Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I served as a member appointed by the Attorney General to the Law Commission work group that was referenced and drafted a number of bills around ethics-related issues, particularly House Bill 2597. Mr. Chairman, I'm here really representing myself as a member of that at the request of the committee staff. I want to first let you know that Wendy Johnson really fairly and accurately represented the discussion that occurred in front of the Law Commission work group. So I'll add just some comments of my own. I think you have to be, as I am, a registered lobbyist in the state, and perhaps you all receive these letters, I don't know, but I receive a variety of post-campaign letters that are asking for assistance in purchase of computers, assistance with staff, assistance with mailings throughout the session. And as, again, a registered lobbyist, I find myself in the odd position of I can, as Wendy described, write the check but can't give the gift. And it is the oddest dichotomy, and it has a certain ring of insincerity on the part of the legislature to pass rules relative to lobbyists and maintain a campaign finance system that just takes a circle around the rules. And I would suggest to you that as you look at this entire issue of ethics, how to manage the lobby and its relationship with you, that you will catch all the snares dealing with the lunches and ball games and the rest of it, and you will ignore the tiger trap, and that is this campaign finance issue. It is a major problem. It is a fundamental ethical problem that has not been addressed. I know from my own period as a candidate, as a member of the legislature, as a campaign manager for a number of races, including some statewides over the years, and as a lobbyist, this is a very, very difficult and delicate area. I think we found in House Bill 2597 a way out of this that coupled with the kind of discussion you're having on fair and adequate funding for legislative service, offers a real solution to what I think is just a growing problem. In addition, I think you'd find, as you talk to members of the lobby, as we did, we had a number of lobbyists as advisors on this committee, that there is deep concern in the lobby about the use of campaign funds during campaigns, and I think it's addressed here, in which campaign funds are passed through individual candidate committees to other individual candidate committees. And I think if you talk with lobbyists, I know as you all do, and ask them about this, there's real deep concern about this kind of movement of campaign funds through the system. This deals with that. And I guess finally, I had a very difficult time during the discussion. This went on for 18 months, and your comfort level moves around on issues like this. During the discussion, former Justice Hans Lindy, who can be very persuasive over time, as he talks with you over time on a variety of issues, finally persuaded me that, and I think other members of the work group, that looking at the campaign committees as a trust with the treasurer in a fiduciary responsibility to both the candidate but ultimately to the public for maintenance of that trust is a very interesting model as a way to manage this. I know that in handling a couple of campaigns that I've dealt with on a statewide basis, I found that the best way to do it for myself, just to make sure everything ended up okay at the end, was that I couldn't sign checks and the candidate couldn't sign the checks. You had to have only a treasurer sign them. The result was, I think, a very orderly and intelligent use of the money for the election of the candidate, with minimal amount going for lunches and dinners and travel and a variety of other expenses that I think we're all familiar with in campaigning. I think that Professor Lindy really got to the heart of what that problem looks like. Somebody has to take responsibility that currently is only developed through the campaign organization in an informal way, that he really set up a structure that would guarantee the public very responsible and appropriate use of those campaign funds. And the only, I guess what you have to do is sit down and read, like Wendy did, like a number of us did, the CNEs for just a period of time coming out of these legislative campaigns to recognize how funds are being used in a very, very liberal interpretation of what is associated with a campaign and what is personal use. So I think anyone with just a moment reviewing them would come away saying, this makes me uncomfortable. If nothing else, it's going to make you uncomfortable, particularly in an environment where you all are passing rules regarding severe limitations on issues like flowers and lunch. And I think that when you're doing that, you really have to take a look at this part seriously. I sincerely believe you've got an opportunity, because you have looked at flowers and lunch. You've got a real chance to look at where the real problem is, which is campaign funds. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bennett. We have a number of people that we want to hear from, and we have only about 30 minutes left at the most. So we're going to have to ask members to only ask questions if it's really burning, and we'll have to ask witnesses to be as succinct as possible. Okay, with that, Janice.
Thank you. Janice Thompson with the Money and Politics Research Action Project. I also appreciate the invitation by committee staff to echo many of what the comments made by Chuck Bennett. I was also a participant in the Law Commission's Interim Ethics Work Group. Did prepare some written testimony and trying to provide a visual where, this whole notion that where the rub comes in are where some of the 260 and 244 provisions overlap regarding, as Wendy said, the defraying office expenses, the double dipping, and as referred to by Chuck, the pass-through. And I think the policy goal here is to separate that and kind of make them, you know, pull them out. I agree, as Wendy said, with the principles from the work group. I actually quoted one of them, and I just want to bring to your attention. Wendy and her staff has put together a really good report on all the bills that came from this interim process that provides a lot of the background information. So, you know, as you read subsequent bills, I really recommend that you get this and take a look at this. And the bill, as Chuck mentioned, on this topic is House Bill 2597. We definitely support that bill. Have two suggestions related to the bill. One, I'll just let you read it. Just as one other area about a ORS 260 violation for which it seems like campaign funds should not be allowed to be used. The second item, however, Chuck and I were just talking about this. We thought actually that there was discussion through the interim process that also legal fees should not be an allowed use for campaign funds. But as I read the bills, that didn't quite get in there, so maybe we're both confused about what got decided. But regardless, it seems like that is important to add. And this is all, both of those items, one and two, are really feasible in large part because there's the option in 2596 to form a legal expense trust fund. But the third and fourth option or suggestions here relate to, as has been mentioned, the need to increase budgets to adequately pay for office expenses. And this item four is, I mean, as an organization, we definitely support increasing legislative pay and as well as judicial pay. But I think in this area, what you need to take a look at is to refine or adjust per diem expense policies. And others, many other states do have a greater differential linked to how far somebody lives from the capital. I know that there is a differential, as I understand it, during the interim, but I think it would apply during the legislative session. And that is really where the, you know, in terms of tying these restrictions on use of campaign funds to things, that is should be tied to that and not viewed as essential to tie it to the increase in pay, even though I support the increase in pay. It's just I don't think they need to be linked. And then finally, to reiterate, this is a very, very important topic in Senate Bill 10 and other bills. People are talking about restrictions on gifts and meals. I support those ideas, but we're going to have a major problem here and very much a situation where I think this body would be, you know, subject to grave criticism but not really addressing some problems if these stronger rules on use of campaign funds are not also adopted.
Thank you. Questions? Thank you very much, both of you. Okay, I'd like to call up as a panel Paul Hurd, Jerry Gatos, and Bill Simon.
My name is Jerry Johnson, Your Honor, and I'm going to horn in on this panel,
okay.
So thank you.
Okay. Let me grab another chair up there.
Talking about delinking things, I'm going to have to delink.
Yeah, is there a loose chair somewhere that we could? Okay, who wants to go first?
I'm willing to start. My name is Paul Hurd, Chairman Rowe, members of the committee. I'm general counsel at Freightliner LLC, and I was honored to be asked by Chief Justice Dominguez to chair the Task Force on Judicial Excellence. And I'll keep my remarks very brief. The report, I think, is pretty comprehensive. It lays out the problem. A couple of key facts that I want the committee to understand is that this is something that's very important to business and business lawyers. The competence and experience of our judiciary is something that we value greatly. I've been involved in litigating cases for over 30 years as a trial lawyer, as a prosecutor, and then in-house at Freightliner, and we litigate cases all over the country. And I can assure you that as a business lawyer, it is extremely important to me to have the most capable, bright, talented people that we can find on the bench. All we really want is, as business people, is somebody who's, we don't want someone who's biased one way or the other. We want somebody who's going to make a fair call and someone that has the talent and the experience to do that. And I'm afraid that what is happening here in Oregon is, or what's going to happen is, we're going to lose the ability to attract the kind of people we need to the bench to accomplish that job. I hire lawyers to work in our legal department. I can tell you that the youngest, least experienced lawyer in my legal department makes more than Chief Justice DeMunis. Now, that is just not right. And it's something that I think as a state we really need to fix. To be 50th out of 51, I mean, it's in Oregon is kind of lurching toward being the new Mississippi. And we just, it's just not something where we want to be. And I think that really this is a problem that we have to address. The other factoid I'll just hit with you and then I'll shut up is that we traced back, I think, the judicial salaries for 29 years against inflation, and you'll see in the report that basically Oregon's judges have been losing ground to inflation for 29 years, which, in essence, looked at another way. In essence, they've been taking a pay cut every year for the past 29 years. So you can see what this is going to do to the ability for us to attract and keep on the bench the kind of people that we want to have there. We're lucky to have the fantastic judges we have, but this is going to slowly go away and erode as the years go by if we don't do something.
Thank you very much. Who's next?
Chair Monroe, Jerry Gatos from Oregon State Bar. I'm a member of the Board of Bar Governors from Eugene and also a business lawyer. But the important thing to bring to you today is the bar's belief in the impartial and independent judiciary and the need to keep that going. And one of the real issues is that the salary, it's one of the variables that attracts people to the public service that being a judge is. The bench needs to have a mix of attorneys. It can't just be folks who are from public sector or private sector. In order to be competitive and make helping people make decisions, those salaries must be increased. I really want to echo what Chief Justice said earlier and maybe expand a little bit on it. It's not just talking about the bench. It's talking about the safety of the communities. It's talking about dispute resolution. It's talking about safe families. It's talking about the kind of issues that are extremely important to each of you and to the state and to all the members. So in order to really have your commitment and the state recognize this significant contribution judiciary makes to all those roles, salary is a component that really needs to be addressed. And I truly appreciate your willingness to listen and wish you the best on this decision.
Thank you. Mr. Sine?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Bill Sine. I'm a lawyer here in private practice in Salem, and I'm also a member of the board of directors of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel. That organization consists of over 600 members of lawyers who devote a substantial portion of their practice to the defense of civil cases. They represent individuals and businesses in both the trial courts and the appellate courts in the state of Oregon. I was also one of the members of the Task Force for Judicial Excellence. I'm here in my capacity as a representative of the Oregon Association of Defense Counsel to voice our strong support for Senate Bill 456 and for the findings and recommendations set forth in this report of the Task Force for Judicial Excellence. There is a vital need to attract and retain qualified and experienced judges judges who have experience in the defense and planting civil cases, judges who have experience in business law and experience in the resolution of complex business issues and complex commercial litigation. And in order to attract and retain those type of judges, we do need to offer fair and appropriate compensation. As you notice in the report that's issued by the Task Force of Judicial Elections, they make a recommendation that we bring our circuit judges up to the level of $125,000 per year. We strongly support that. They also recommend that we bring our appellate judges up a comparable percentage. We strongly support that. That does nothing more than bring Oregon in line with the average of the surrounding states. It does nothing more than bring them close to where they would have been with the cost of living increase going back to the 1970s. It doesn't even bring it up to that. But we strongly support the bill, Senate Bill 456, and the findings of the task force. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Johnson?
Chairman Rowe, members of the committee, thank you for taking the time. My name is Derek Johnson. I'm here as the president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. I'm a plaintiff's personal injury lawyer from the law firm of Johnson, Clifton, Larson, Schaller in Eugene, Oregon. It is a rare day when Bill Syme and I recommend the same amount to a decision maker, but I'm here to do that. Our members are throughout the state work with judges day in and day out. We work with judges deciding pretrial motions, work with them on settlement conferences, and we work with them when we try cases. To date, the Oregon judiciary is tremendous. We have wonderful, capable, competent people on the bench. We don't want to lose that. This is an opportunity to retain and recruit new members to the bar or to the bench, and we encourage this committee and the full body to pass Senate 456 with the numbers that Mr. Syme has recommended, and to continue to compensate the people that are on the front lines of making these decisions day in and day out in a manner that is appropriate for the work that they're doing. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Are there questions for the panel? Thank you very much. Now we will go to Mark Gardner and Dan Harris. And I'd just like to say on 456, that's a bill that ultimately, if we decide to act on it, we'll need to go down to Ways and Means. So what we would be doing would be sending it down there for funding. Mr. Gardner.
Chairman Monroe and members of the committee, my name is Mark Gardner. I'm a circuit court judge and have served in that capacity for over 25 years. Prior to my appointment and election to the bench, I was a member of the Oregon House of Representatives for two terms. The extremely low salaries paid to Oregon judges is having a negative impact on judicial retirements. Judges are leaving the bench prior to reaching retirement age because of the need to generate more income to support their families, the need to pay for a child's college education on a salary that isn't subject to even modest cost of living increases for periods of years can cause even the most public-spirited judge to reconsider their commitment to a career in the judiciary. Those judges that stay on the bench to retirement age of 60 are increasingly retiring soon after to seek a more lucrative second career in mediation or arbitration to supplement their retirement income. The Task Force for Judicial Excellence has noted this trend, reporting that in the years 1995 and 96, of the 11 judges that resigned or retired, two were age 60 or below, compared to the time period of 2005 and 2006, where 22 judges resigned or retired and 11 were age 60 or younger. Why should the legislature be concerned? The answer is clear. Oregon is losing its best and brightest judges, those with the greatest expertise, at a point in their career when they can be the most productive. Surprisingly, this doesn't concern some members of the public, and even more surprisingly, the legislature. They don't support spending more money to attract or retain better qualified judges. They rationalize that as long as there's a warm body to fill a judicial seat, no problem exists. What they fail to understand is that lower judicial ability or expertise leads to poorer decisions, more appeals, greater costs, and less public respect for the judiciary and government generally. I urge your support for Senate Bill 456 with amendments to reflect a salary level equal to the average salary of judges in the western states. I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. And Judge Gardner, come up to my office sometime. I have a 30-year-old picture of the legislature in 1977 when you and I were both freshmen.
We probably had a lot darker hair, too.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman Rowe and members of the committee. My name is Dan Harris. I come to you today from the Rogue Valley, Southern Oregon. I have been a circuit court judge there for the last 10 years. Before I was a circuit judge, I practiced law as a representative of small businesses and as a trial attorney. Over the last 10 years as I've served on the bench, I've noticed an alarming disinterest, a growing disinterest by lawyers in joining the bench and being on the bench. I've also seen a decrease in the pool of those who are qualified to sit on the bench. In 1997, when I became a judge, 24 lawyers competed for that position. In 2004, three lawyers competed for the open position. And then last year, in 2006, four lawyers competed for that position. I've seen a decline in the amount of experience that's been brought. Among the 24 lawyers who competed for the position, When I was appointed, most of them have more than 15 years experience. The lawyers stepping forward today, those few who are stepping forward with interest, have less experience than that. So this is a direct result of the economic realities that we face. I have the last 5 years been doing my best to recruit the legal talent I find in Jackson County. And the response I get from them is, I can't take that big of a pay cut. I would love to do public service, but I can't afford to do that. And then the next response is, how do you do it? And most of us say, well, our spouses go to work or we find another job in the evening or something. The joke around the judiciary is we could wait tables on weekends if we needed extra income, but that certainly isn't appropriate to our position. So I would urge you to consider the two proposals that are before you for an immediate increase in salary so that we can hold on to the judges we have. I know that if there's not an immediate increase, there are a number of judges in Southern Oregon who will be retiring, and I don't know who they'll be replaced by. That is of concern to me. And, of course, the long-term solution that the Chief Justice referred to is essential for the stability of salaries in the future. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And our last panel will be John Ledger, Kathy Eaton, and Mark Nelson. Mr. Ledger, you're going to go first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm John Ledger, Vice President of Associated Oregon Industries, and I'll be very brief because I think we've heard very compelling arguments on this issue. AOI supports an increase in compensation for judges. That position was adopted by the board of directors of AOI prior to the legislative session, and I'd just like to bring to you a letter supporting increased compensation signed by our chairman of the board of directors and have that entered into the record. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Oregon Judges Association. I had signed up on both SJR 1 and Senate Bill 50. Very briefly, I think as the committee administrator knows, we have another draft of a bill which sets out a statutory public officials compensation commission. We believe that that is constitutional. We're working on a brief, so to speak, for you to bring that to you. We know there's some disagreement within the legislative council. We believe this is very similar to the council on court procedures. That it works exactly in effect the same way, and we want that opportunity to come back to you and offer that as an amendment. We have it set now to drop on the House side. It's not yet out of council, but we'd probably bring that back to you as an amendment for you to look at and look at the various opinions and see which way you want it to go.
Well, Mr. Nelson, that was my preference, and I've talked to staff about it. I was hoping that we could get this all done without the necessity of a public vote. But on the other hand, it is also essential, I think, that legislators not be asked to vote on their own salaries. So if we can accomplish that, that's fine. Our legislative counsel, you heard him, Mr. McKean, said that wasn't possible. So, show me your evidence.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And Ms. Eaton.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Kathy Eaton. I'm the governance coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. I'd like to comment briefly on 50, number one, and 456. We were present at most of the discussions that took place with the Public Commission on the Legislature and some of those with the Law Commission, and we're very much in support of the reactivation of the Public Officials Compensation Commission. We believe that there's a close link between campaign funds and the compensation of public officials, as has been pointed out to you by others today. Current salaries for all public officials, even when adjusted for inflation, are below all the other Western states and actually declined 3.2% between 1975 and 2005. Legislators continue to have fiscal difficulties with meeting the demands of their offices, which include local meetings with constituents, organizational functions, and attending peer-related professional conferences such as those given by the Conference on State Government. Yet there are problems with just how much of their campaign funds legislators can legally use for these activities. We believe that reasonable curbs on the use of campaign funds can be enacted if reasonable and equitable salaries are set by an independent commission. Legislators would be relieved of the unenviable task of setting salaries for themselves and others, making the legislature more accountable and open in the eyes of public. With regard to Senate Bill 456, the League is just completing a two-year, rather comprehensive research study on the Oregon judiciary. We have interviewed all of the 27 district court judges and the court administrators, and frankly, we've been appalled at what we find the fiscal condition of the judiciary in Oregon, and we certainly hope that you will take care of that situation. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions for any of these people? Thank you very much. I also have a letter from Treasurer Edwards that I'm in support of Senate Joint Resolution 1, which we'll submit for the record. Is there anybody else that wanted to be heard on these issues today?
I like it.
Okay, anything from the committee? Next week we will have the Legislative Council draft in our hands for introduction.
Plan.
That's the plan. Thank you. We're adjourned.